Good evening, you guys. Sorry I'm a little bit late. K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. My call letters, my name is Dick. You're going to be also hearing from another fine gentleman named Mel, K2, Kilo, Echo, Yankee. Mel and Dick gather the clan on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock to run a thing we call the TechNet. 27 years, it tries to answer the logical questions that ham radio operators have. They're curious people, they have a scientific interest, and so any question of interest to ham radio operators, usually about wireless, usually involves wireless technology, and usually involves things like transmitters and antennas, receivers and whatever, but not always. Ham's got questions on a lot of other subjects. Sometimes people are a little bit unhappy about that, that we allow it to go kind of far and wide. We don't force people to listen. They do have a dial, and if that bothers them, they can go somewhere else. Mel and I do get letters from people who are quite pleased about just two things. One, that we do go a little bit far and wide at times, because a lot of things eventually relate to what ham radio operators like to do. And also, I, for one, get a little bit long-winded, and there are people who get quite unhappy about that, and there are other people who say, please keep doing it, because it's the only place where we can get the more complete story. The books are not telling us enough. The courses are not telling us enough. Wireless technology, the way it's being taught in our schools, in my opinion, could be done a hell of a lot better. We're using old-fashioned techniques in the way we're teaching the subject, and it's not being kept anywhere near as modern as, say, the subject of computer science and software engineering and things like that. Those courses are being kept very current. The courses that try to teach people the way radios work, that those courses seem to have had their curriculum set in right after World War II, and it hasn't changed since. They've always done it that way. And they haven't yet, the people who are doing the teaching and the people who are setting the curriculum haven't yet quite realized that if you keep doing it the way you've always done, you'll keep getting what you've always got. And that's not necessarily acceptable. As it is right now, if you want to find a person who understands radio and wireless technology, with high probability you have to hire a ham radio operator who has had 5 or 10 or 15 years of experience of building antennas and setting up transmission lines and studying propagation. You have to find a hands-on enthusiast, a ham radio operator, if you really want to understand radio and antennas, because it's not being well taught. A lot of that's my opinion, but there are people who should...
Repeater, time out.
Now, there's a good example of a long-winded guy. There are other people who share that opinion. So it's not only my opinion. And the TechNet tries to correct that. We try to give people the information they need to know to understand what Mother Nature is telling them in the way their equipment and the way Mother Nature behaves and the way radios or waves propagate. And so, with your help, and by that I mean a high percentage of the data that gets transmitted on this net comes from the people who are listening, who say, yeah, I know something about that, and this is what I know. And Mel and Dick don't know it all. They'll admit that right off the bat. Although we've been at this game for 40 years, there's a hell of a lot of things we have to learn all the time. With your help, we do that learning. It's a sharing process. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. This is what a typical sign-in would sound like. N2EO, Rich, and yes. Now, he's one of the people who frequently signs in. So give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
Anthony to say in. Yes. This is N2YJC. The name is Lou, and yes, good evening, Dick.
This is K2KEY. Can I say a few words, Dick?
Absolutely, Mel. So far, we've got Wesley and Lou signing in. Wesley and Lou. Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, a little later on, we'll continue the discussion on balance that we've been sort of trying to cover the last couple of weeks. And a few questions came up, And if you'd like to follow along on the next part of Dick and myself's tutelage, just get yourself a sheet of paper, a straight edge, and a pencil, and we'll be able to pick up a little later on, Dick. And I will leave some room so that we can finish covering the subject, Dick. I think if you can manage it, you know, leave a sufficient amount of time, over.
Okay, very glad to hear that, Mel. You guys are quite lucky. You've tuned into one of the nights in which there is going to be, near the end, a packaged program presented by Mel. In the past, he's got a very good track record of presenting a packaged program on the subject of how does a Smith chart work, how do transmission lines work, how do decibels work. And these were some of the frequent questions that Mel got through his email and other snail mail, and he presented a package on those. And if you go to the website where the majority of everything you're hearing gets recorded, that's the website called, I don't know what name it's got. All I'm saying is that you're going to listen to the TechNex section of the website, which is at the address of www.amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tv. You go to that particular website, you go to the section that talks about the Limark Technical Net, and for the last 4 years or so, every one of these programs is recorded. You go to the right year, you go to the right month, you go to the right Sunday session, you download that particular reel. They're in one-hour reels, so to speak, and you listen to that particular reel. Most of them are documented. In other words, what subject is being discussed each 5 or 10 minutes, there's a couple of words alongside of that. That's very nicely done by an enthusiastic man named Mike Perry, Kilo Charlie Tune, November Juliet, India, who does all that work. A yeoman service. A labor of love, as I see it. Thousands of hours of stuff is there. You will also see individual packages that you can go to on the subject of decibels, Smith chart, how to get better tuning of a Yagi. You'll find individual packages that were presented by mostly Mel and one of them by me, also on that particular website at that address. And if you need me, you can ask me for a repeat on that so far. I mean, later on I'll repeat that address again. It's been there for like 4 years. So far, once again, we've got Wesley and Lou. Is there anyone else who wants to sign into the TechNet because they do have a question or a comment they want to make? Please give me your call letters and your name at this time. K2RIW.
KC2SYL. The name is Bill, and yes.
Bill recognized. Anyone else?
WS2N. Name is Paul. No for now, Dick. Back to you.
And for those guys who have tuned in frequently, you know that Paul is our space expert. Paul, should I save some time to you tonight so that you can tell us what NASA and our astronauts and our cosmonauts are doing? Over to you, Paul.
I don't have anything busy with the bad weather and everything, and I really haven't checked into what they've been doing in the last week or so. So don't have any updates, but if anybody has any questions, we're here for that, Dick.
I'm going to take you up on that one, Paul. Briefly, give me your best assessment. I think it is Spirit is the one that has the front right wheel that has failed, and they've been dragging it by making those six wheels, the five remaining wheels, go in reverse. So it's been backing up everywhere it goes. And Spirit eventually got itself stuck in some soft sand. Give me a couple of words as your best guess. Is it going to survive the winter? Will it get unstuck? Or is it going to be something that's now planted in one spot and it keeps making measurements from that area? What's your best guess on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Scientists are very happy that they got stuck where they did because the dragging and getting back and forth, and they actually dug into the terrain around Spirit. And, you know, it is Spirit that with the bad wheel, and the scientists have discovered that this area had water in the past. Opportunity found that pretty much right off in the beginning, but Spirit had to travel miles to finally come up with something conclusive. So they got, you know, they're in a good spot. They many times they said, "Oh no, we might not survive," and they would tilt the rover by driving on a certain angle and maybe just get enough sunlight. You might get a little wind that comes by, clears off the dust on the solar panels. That happened a couple of times, and before you know it, they're on their way again. So I don't know, and they got their fingers crossed. I think it's going to make it, but will they get out of here? It looks like they probably will. I've watched some of the videos with the test rover that they have at JPL in California, and they've got an idea of how to do it, but it's going to take quite a bit of time. Dick, let me drop it. So, you know, it's interesting. Today's the 3rd. Tomorrow makes the 4th when Spirit landed. So you're looking at 6 years of driving around on Mars. And Opportunity followed, 2 weeks later. So it's amazing. I mean, this is 3 months was all that he really hoped to get. I mean, they didn't know that, they didn't think the wheels were going to fall off. And that would be it, 3 months. But they hoped it would go on for maybe 6 months. Here it is, 6 years later, and they're still driving around up there, sending back new information all the time. I mean, if the science stopped, they would stop the rovers. But they'll keep pushing until they quit altogether, Dick. Passing that WS1.
Thank you very much, Paul. That's an encouraging sounding report. Looks like we got more to look forward to. So either 3 or 6 months was all that was guaranteed out of Spirit and Opportunity, these two Mars rovers. They are, to my knowledge, one of the best examples of what a remotely piloted vehicle, an unmanned vehicle in space, can do. Take those vehicles and also the ones that are circling Jupiter and circling Saturn at this time. My goodness, are they gathering an awful lot of good science information, telling us a lot of what's going on. One of the frequent discussions that Wesley and I have had, Wesley is the next person who's going to be up with his question. Wesley and I have had a number of discussions for those who have listened, and along with also Alex in 2NNU. We've had discussions as to whether man will be on the surface of the moon in the next 6, 10, 15, 20 years versus unmanned vehicles. We've had those discussions, and there's pros and cons on both sides of it. A lot more expensive and a lot more risky to send a man. You get a lot more bang for the dollar out of a vehicle, unmanned vehicle. Let's see what Wesley's got to talk to us about tonight. N2XJN, K2RIW, you got it, Wesley. Go slow and worry a little bit about the timeout. Don't do it the way I do it. You got it, Wesley.
November to X-ray, Juliet, November. For the net, in the year 2015, Japanese Space Agency, JAXA, wants to launch a small satellite who will be at the elevation of 36 kilometers, and that would be the first human attempt to send electrical energy, or the energy in force of microwaves, to the Earth. And that's what I would like to bring the attention for of Paul and Dick and the rest of the people. Back to you, Dick, and to Adrian.
Very fine, now, Wesley. I don't completely understand your question, so I'm going to send it back to you. I'm going to tell you what I think I heard, what I think you're saying. You said in the year 2015, which is 5 years from now, the Japan Space Agency, JAXA, is going to send up a satellite. You said 36 kilometers. I wonder if you meant 36,000 kilometers. which is the approximate distance of synchronous orbit, geosynchronous orbit. 21,000 miles or 36,000 kilometers is our geosynchronous orbit. The United States has in the past, I'm making a guess here now, that you're talking about a solar power satellite, which has something like a square kilometer or a square mile of solar cells gathering energy, converting that solar cell energy into microwaves, beaming it down to the Earth, and a rectifying antenna in a place like, say, Arizona, a rectenna, re-rectifies that microwave energy and turns it back into power, which then becomes part of the power grid. So you might be discussing a solar power satellite, which the United States has studied quite a bit, starting in roughly 1970, and I've got quite a bit of opinion on this one. I've read a number of the articles. Not an expert on the subject. So that may be what you're discussing. I'm going to send it back to you, Wesley, to correct me if I've misinterpreted. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN, that's exactly what I was talking about. And I wanted to know what do you think about it. One of the factors that I would like to discuss is the biohazard, which previously in the 60s, when this technology was actually first introduced, actually the thoughts about the technology, because there was nothing about it yet, what they found out in ACE, and that was Russian, they found that the condensed microwave beam will not have the negative effect or effect of biohazard towards the organisms on the Earth, because the intensity in the center will be 230 watts per square meter, and that's the intensity that will not create the biohazards. And all I want is just to find out and ask you to share your knowledge in this matter and to explain.
Okay, this is what I knew as of the articles that appeared in Aviation Week and Space Technology, starting at around 1970-1975 time frame. At that time, to put up a constellation of satellites ringing the Earth to be able to produce a significant amount of power, to put them at that synchronous orbit, 22,000 miles up, 36,000 kilometers, which is 6 Earth radii. If you made a scale model of the Earth, and you've got your globe sitting on your desk, and if you take the radius of the Earth and multiply it by 6 and put your little model of a satellite out there, 3 diameters of the Earth away from the Earth, you put your model, that is the synchronous orbit directly above the equator. So that's where you would be locating these devices. And you'd locate them there because from a ground-based observer, let me drop.
He's off frequency.
Okay, we'll check as to whether or not Wesley is 5KC wrong. I don't think so. His rig has got a fairly enthusiastic voice speech processor, and that may be what you're hearing. Occasionally, Alex does transmit 5KC off, but Wesley tends not to do that. So that may not be it, but he's going to check his dial. So getting back to why do you put something at synchronous orbit directly above the equator, which is one-dimensional real estate. It doesn't have a latitude. It's got to be directly above the equator. It has only a longitude as an address, and so it's a string of beads around the Earth at that particular altitude. That's where the geosynchronous orbit is. From an Earth-based observer, you look up at that satellite, it appears to never move during the 24-hour day. It spins around the Earth at the exact same rate that the Earth rotates, one spin for 24 hours of diurnal time, which is 23 hours, 56 minutes, and some odd, and 40 seconds of sidereal time. We'll get into that later. Anyhow, it sits still. Let me drop. The nice thing about having something in orbit like that is, except for 2 very brief periods, one in March and one in September, when you get an eclipse where the shadow of the Earth and the sun shining on the Earth will fall on your satellite, only during those two particular periods of the year, and it happens for a couple of days. Except for those periods of time, your satellite will be continuously bathed in sunlight 24 hours per day. That's the good news. And with very efficient solar cells, you can gather the energy. With very efficient solid-state or microwave tubes, you can convert the DC power from the solar power satellites into RF energy at, say, 2 gigahertz or 10 gigahertz. Choose the frequency. Then you beam with a nice high-gain antenna, a great big dish or a phased array. You beam that energy down to the Earth. If you're really smart, you set the energy at some reasonable power flux density. In the old days, we used to consider 10 milliwatts per square centimeter as safe. Nowadays, we're becoming more conservative, and we pushed it to 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. But back in the days when it was 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, that represents a power of roughly 100 watts per square meter. The sun gives you 1,300 watts per square meter. So we're talking about something that's something like 7 or 8% of the energy of the sun will be this microwave beam. And therefore, the rectifying antenna on the ground in a place, let's say, out in the desert of Arizona or New Mexico is one possible proposed area where you beam the signal down. Let me drop. You rectify the energy, you put it onto the, you make it into 60 cycle power, and you put it onto the national grid. And now you're getting power 24 hours a day, and it's really green power, renewable energy resource. These are all the good newses. There's a couple of nasty bad newses here. There are people worried about the fact that that beam, when properly focused, represents a weapon. If you aim that beam by over-focusing it so that the power flux density becomes a higher number, like 10, 100, or 1,000 milliwatts per square centimeter, and you aim it at a city, it can create a lot of grief. So you have to put in all kinds of safeties to make sure that kind of an event cannot happen. The solar cells themselves, no matter who manufactures them, no matter how efficient they are, they tend to degrade somewhat in time. So the whole system has a certain wear-out period. These are some of the disadvantages you've heard about. The most significant disadvantage, unfortunately, is economic. Let me drop. According to the article I read in Aviation Week and Space Technology of roughly 1972, if my memory is right, maybe it's 74, but somewhere in that time frame, the estimated cost of the installation was $2 trillion in 1972 money. The total number of launches required of something like a space shuttle to bring the hardware up to low Earth orbit. Your space shuttle, which is the biggest truck that we've got to put things into orbit. At that time, it was the biggest thing we got, and it could only launch things into low Earth orbit. The space shuttle can never exceed 600 miles above the Earth. In all of its history, over all of its years of use, it has never exceeded something like 280 miles above the Earth. The highest it's ever gone is during the times it does a Hubble Space Telescope repair. That's the highest object that has ever been visited by the space shuttle. Let me drop. So your great big hard lifting, your great big lifting hardware, whether it be something like a Saturn V, or it be something like the replacement vehicle for the space shuttle or the space shuttle itself, those objects only get you into low Earth orbit. Then it takes another very large pyrotechnic Apogee kick motor to kick it the rest of the way, and to kick it from, let's say, 500 miles above the Earth to be 22,000 miles above the Earth, a hell of a lot more energy is required. So, and by the way, there's another big problem. If any of the hardware fails, you cannot send a man there to repair it. It'd be nice to send up the space shuttle and do a repair. Space shuttle can't go above 600 nautical miles, absolute maximum. And even then, you're pushing your luck to go that far. So you're not going to send a man out there to repair it. You're going to make some very fancy robots, maybe, and it's an extremely expensive installation. If you look at the alternative, let me drop. The amount of solar energy you get in space and the amount of solar energy you get on the surface of the planet and a place where the sun shines rather well and you don't have a whole lot of clouds, a place like Arizona or New Mexico, It's kind of close. Get close to 1,200 watts per square meter of solar energy hitting Arizona. In space, you'll get 1,300 watts per square meter. You'll get a little bit more ultraviolet. You get a little bit more capability, but let me pick a number. 75, 80, 85% of the energy you could get in space in watts per square meter from the sun. You're getting the exact same amount of energy on the surface of the energy on the Earth, you know, 80%, 90% of it. That's the good news. The bad news is that you don't get the sun 24 hours a day in Arizona. However, half a loaf is better than none. To make the same amount of power be generated by solar cells in Arizona probably is 0.1 or 0.01% of the price of the installation of the solar space satellite, of the solar power satellite. So therefore, you'd be investing 1/100th or 1/1,000th the amount of money. The good news, you only get the energy half the time, 12 hours per day instead of 24, but that's an awful good trade-off. So for economic reasons, it is my belief that this proposal of the Japan Space Agency might not take place for the reason of economics as well as some of the others. That's my first guess on it, and that's what I've gathered from the Aviation Week and Space Technology articles. Maybe those articles are biased. Maybe I've become biased. Let me drop a little bit to see if anyone else wants to join this discussion, and if not, Alex is going to tell us, Wesley is going to tell us a little more about his opinion. Is there anyone else that wants to add their words on this particular subject, solar power satellites? Please give me your call letters right now, K2LIW and the TechNet. There being none, Wesley, you have the floor. I am curious as to how enthusiastic you are about it, Wesley, and do you believe that with modern technology, some of those disadvantages I've mentioned can maybe be overcome? N2XJN, KQRIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. Before that, expressing my opinion, I need some help asking a few questions. What would happen with the cloud that is passing by through the beam that is focused on in Arizona on that big antenna, that is receiving antenna? And the second, will there be any change to the physical property of the atmosphere right under the influence of that beam? Any anomaly at all? Back to you, this 10-2XJN.
Don, good questions. And I got good news on both of those questions. Number one, at the time that that proposal was being done in the late 70s or early 70s, I know that the idea probably started maybe in an Eastern Bloc nation, maybe in the Soviet Union and in the late 60s, but it became a popular idea of discussion in the 70s. At that time, they thought the so-called unified S-band, in other words, approximately 2.3 gigahertz, was one of the more desirable frequencies because we had transmitting tubes and solid-state circuitry that could generate a lot of power at that frequency. With a big enough antenna, you can get enough antenna directivity to make a beam that you can focus well enough on a place like Arizona or New Mexico. So the chosen frequency then was 2 gigs. The way technology has progressed, I am guessing today we would do it more like X-band or Ku-band, around 10 gigs or 15 gigs is my guess, for a bunch of reasons. However, a 2-gig signal going through a cloud experiences an amount of attenuation that's extremely small, obvious by the fact that I, for one, used a television receive-only terminal. That's one of these 10-foot diameter dishes to listen to a 5-watt video signal from synchronous orbit at 3.8 to 4.2 gigahertz was the downlink frequencies. I listened to those frequencies during heavy rainstorms when great big clouds came in the middle of the dish. And the attenuation, I would say, was probably never more than 1 or 2 tenths of a dB. And when I got an extremely heavy cloud, the heavy cloud with a lot of water into it represented, let me drop. It represented a dielectric medium which acted like a lens, and it would steer the beam from the satellite down to my backyard, in a slightly different manner. I know because on a couple of occasions, an extremely heavy cloud came along. The signal became kind of fuzzy. We got a lot of sparklies, as they call it, when it comes to satellite reception. I was getting white speckles across the screen, representing a decrease in carrier-to-noise ratio. If I reoriented the antenna during that time, the signal came back. And as soon as the cloud passed, I reversed the process and put the antenna back in the direction it was aimed before. I had a motor on the antenna so I could steer each one of the 25 satellites in sequence and listen to each one of them. So I saw the cloud give me a little bit of change in the shaping of the aiming of the beam, very similar to the so-called scintillation effect. On a sunny day, if you look at the bottom of your pool and there's waves of water on the top, you'll see the shadows in the bottom of the pool move around in a funny way because of the waves of the water on the top. And what the water is doing is slightly deflecting the sunlight, and you get bright spots and dark spots that move around. It's called the scintillation effect in your pool. Well, the atmosphere does that. So I saw a scintillation effect, but I saw essentially no attenuation. As you go higher in frequency toward 10 gigahertz, rain attenuation does definitely increase. So there's an ideal frequency you'd have to choose. And I'm guessing somewhere around 2 to 4 gigahertz. If there's an empty frequency region around there, that's where I think they would choose. Atmosphere attenuation, even during heavy rainstorms, short of the kind of downpour you get in Bangladesh, I mean, there you can get rain rates that are out of sight, but shy of that, you get very little atmospheric attenuation. The next thing Wesley was concerned about, let me drop, is atmospheric heating. You probably know there is an artificial ionospheric generator that we have located in a couple of places around the 50 United States, in which you take this huge array, which is about an acre of antenna, at say 400 megacycles, you put a megawatt of power into it, you aim it up at the ionosphere, and you artificially ionize the ionosphere. You can make an artificial ionosphere, so that if I put that artificial ionospheric heater in, say, Chicago, and if a buddy of mine wanted to do radio propagation between Seattle, Washington, and Washington, D.C., there's a lot of Earth curvature between the two. Getting the signal there would be kind of difficult, particularly during a low spot in the sunspot cycle. If I turn on my ionospheric heater in Chicago, assuming Chicago was midway between the two, I'm now creating an artificial cloud. The signal bounces off that ionosphere, and now Seattle is talking to Washington with a high signal-to-noise ratio, in my example. So those kind of artificial ionospheric heaters are transmitting an amount of power flux density, watts per square meter, that are many orders of magnitude higher than what this solar power satellite would do. The nice thing about an antenna is that if you give it enough area, enough square meters of the emitting surface of the antenna, then the power flux density is very low, even though the total amount of power is very high. Let me give you an example of that. If I took my kilowatt transmitter on 432, the so-called parallel kilowatt amplifier, which was in April and May 1972, QST magazine, way back in the dark ages, and people are still using those for moonbounds. Okay, here's a 3-pound amplifier with 4CX250B tubes, 3 pounds if you don't count the power supply, which puts out 700 watts of power, 17 dB of gain. If I took that amplifier with 700 watts of output, put it into a simple corner reflector antenna on 432, and stood in front of that antenna at, say, 5 feet, the total amount of RF energy striking my body would be above the threshold of alarm. If I stood there for 6 minutes, I could do damage, probably to my cornea of my eyes. If I left my eyes open, stared into the antenna, stood there for 6 minutes, with the transmitter key down, I could do damage. And that's a corner reflector antenna with, let's say, 7 or 8 dB of gain. If I took the exact same kilowatt of power, put it into a 28-foot diameter parabolic dish antenna, which has close to 30 decibels of gain. The corner reflector had, let's say, 7.5 dB of gain. I'm putting it on the antenna with 30 decibels of gain and 1,000 watts going into it. That means my effective radiated power out of that antenna, let me drop, 30 dB of antenna gain, plus plus 30 dBW of power. That's 1 million watts of affected radiated power coming out of that antenna. Let's assume the antenna is set up aimed at the horizon. I stand on a step ladder in the middle of the antenna. It's a 28-foot diameter dish antenna. The center is 14 feet above the ground. I stand on a step ladder 14 feet above the ground directly in front of that antenna with 1 million watts of effective radiated power. A person with normal common sense would say, wow, Dick is crazy. He's going to be fried in 30 seconds if he does that. Turns out Dick could do that. KQLIW could do that for the next 365 days and nothing would happen because it is taking the kilowatt of power, smearing it across 28-foot diameter dish, 615 square feet, and you can convert that to square meters if you like. It's around 65 square meters. The energy is being smeared across all of that area of the dish and then transmitted in this 28-foot diameter beam forward. Because the power is being so nicely focused but spread out into this wide beam, it becomes safe. So if you make the antenna big enough that's doing the transmitting, the power coming out of it in watts per square meter becomes safe, opposite of common sense. But it's pretty much a reality, and you can double-check that. So the beam coming out of this solar power satellite, if there's enough square meters or enough square miles of the transmitting antenna, the beam becomes very safe. Well, there's a catch. As that array that's doing the transmitting, let me drop, becomes bigger and bigger, you have the ability to doing what's called near-field focusing. You could focus at a point on the ground 36,000 kilometers below you, 21,000 miles below the satellite, right at the surface of the Earth. You could focus that beam into a much smaller number of square meters, and you could make it now become a more dangerous beam. But shy of doing that, you're not going to get artificial heating of the ionosphere or atmosphere, and you're not going to get very much interference with clouds if you choose the right frequency. So technologically speaking, you can make this thing fly. The most difficult part is the fact that no human being can go there to repair it. The equipment is going to break down. The installation is extremely expensive. And if I compare the economics of, let me drop, if I filled up half of the state of Arizona with solar cells, and if I used the cheap, yucky solar cells of today, 8 or 10% efficiency, but I use enough of them, I can gather the power during the time the sun shines, and that's half the battle. And then if I can make an agreement with somebody on the other side of the earth, where when the sun shines on him, he gathers the power and we both share it. But maybe we can work out techniques like that. But I would like to see us use a lot more renewable energy resources of wind, solar, tide, the Gulf Stream, all kinds of geothermal. There's lots and lots of energy resources available to us if we make the investment. And this particular investment of a solar power satellite, I'm very doubtful it's going to take place. I think the Soviet Union has studied it a lot. The United States has studied it a lot. The European Space Agency has studied it a lot. The Japanese Space Agency sounds like they're giving it some serious consideration. I am doubtful they will actually go and do it. But I might be wrong. Back to you, Wesley. Don, interesting question. N2XJN, K2LIW.
N2XJN, you forgot to say something about reverse problem. You were talking about the transmitting antenna. If the transmitting antenna, in order to get 1 gigawatt of power, is in space of the diameter of 1 kilometer, the receiving antenna will have at least 4 kilometers of parabolic structure. Now, you were talking about focusing to near Earth beam. Of course, it's going to be focusing because this energy has to go inside that big antenna, receiving antenna. But then, this receiving parabolic antenna will have a center element inside that will actually collect all of this energy. What is then going to happen with the physical properties of the atmosphere there would be any anomaly, if there would be any biohazard, if there would be any problem with that. Back to you, Dick, and to exam.
Okay, the way you've discussed it, Wesley, you made it sound like maybe the transmitting antenna in the out in space is going to be a big parabolic dish, and the receiving antenna on the ground is going to be a big parabolic dish. That's a possible proposal. I say no. I say the transmitting antenna in space will be a phased array. In other words, there'll be a whole lot of individual emitting transmitters and individual emitting antennas, and a great big flat sheet, so to speak, having a whole lot of X and Y dimension, but very little Z dimension to it. The advantage of a great big phased array for doing the transmitting is you now have what's called graceful degradation. That phased array doing the transmitting, maybe it's going to be, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air, 3 kilometers wide and 3 kilometers high, 9 square kilometers. I'm just picking numbers out of the air. And I'm going to smear thousands of individual transmitters and thousands of individual transmitting antennas within that structure. And all I've got to do is make sure that every one of those transmitters is phase-locked to their adjacent brethren. Make sure that they're all transmitting a signal in phase. And even if it goes out of phase, there's ways I can discuss what happens to what's called beam spoiling, intentional or unintentional beam spoiling. But I can control that. But I call it graceful degradation. Let me drop. Because if individual transmitters and individual antennas of that phased array in space fail and go off the air, it becomes a partially filled array. The beam will degrade very little. The total power output will degrade very little until the percentage of failure gets high. I could have an array of 10,000 transmitters, and if 1% of them fail, I'm still transmitting 99% of the power if I do it as a phased array. By the same token, the receiving antenna on the ground, you could do it as a multi-mile diameter parabolic dish. But to make a dish that big, to maintain the surface accuracy, to maintain the accuracy with wind load, snow load, sag of the metal, and all these other things, and aiming capability, very, very difficult. The biggest dish we've ever built is the Arecibo 1,000-foot diameter dish, and you don't want to build one of those in Arizona. All you've got to do is build another phased array on the ground to do all the collecting. It'll look almost identical to the phased array that's doing the transmitting in space. By the law of reciprocity, whatever gain you get from the one in space, you'll get the same gain from the one on the ground. And the nice thing about the phased array on the ground, let me drop, is that now you can very rapidly, very conveniently, electronically steer that beam of the reception on the ground. By changing the phase of the reception of the individual antennas and the individual rectifiers, you've now, again, on the ground, got graceful degradation. If individual elements of the phased array fail, you're still 99% on the air, so to speak. And now each individual device is running at a reasonable level of power. Going out there and repairing individual elements is relatively easy and safe. Whereas with that great big parabolic dish and everything coming to one common focus with a gigawatt of power at that focus, no human being can get within 300 yards of that location and survive. You can't go there to do repair and to collect that much power and rectify it. See, you can't use RF energy on a power grid. You've got to convert the RF energy into DC voltage. That's one approach. And then convert the DC voltage eventually into 60-cycle AC with a cycloconverter or an inverter and so on. So I think the antenna on the ground is going to be a phased array if you did do it. And it's not only going to be cheaper, but more electronically adaptable, and it has more graceful degradation. I think you see where I'm going on that one. I don't know if that's the way the Japan Space Agency has proposed to do it, but I guess that there's a high probability they will go somewhat in that direction when they more thoroughly study the problem, if they haven't already decided to go that way. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. Well, my great honor to listen to what you say, because this is exactly what the Japan is proposing. I thought that you could have me concentrating yourself on the parabolic antenna and all of that problems that comes from that. The only thing is that with that scenario, the typical antenna will be 10 kilometers or a square kilometer, 10 kilometers of the radial. Just to get, I don't know how many square miles that would be, just to get the 1 gigawatt power, knowing that 230 watts per meter is the maximum that is, actually you said 180, that is allowed. Now, the Japanese believes that with the expense of $6,000 to $11,000 that is estimated right now per kilogram of electronics and mechanics driven to the earth, they will be able to go to $400-$500 per kilogram, and that's why that they still didn't drop that idea. And it looks like it's 100 times reduction of the expenses. We'll see. And I just thought that Paul is going to say anything about it. Anyhow, thank you very much for taking the subject into the consideration. This is N2HJN.
Yeah, as I see it, Wesley, you brought to our attention a fascinating subject because it involves many of the elements of what a ham radio operator does when he studies what is required to make a high-performance, moon-bound ham radio installation. There are approximately on and off, I guess, 400 or 500 or so people scattered around the world who can transmit a strong enough signal on a usual so-called microwave frequency. One or two of those guys have done it on 6 meters. Many of them have done it on 2 meters, 432, 1296, 2, 3, 5 gigs, and 10 gigs, and a few of them have done it on 22 gigs, and one of them is talking about doing it on 47 gigs. So these guys, on these frequencies, can develop enough antenna gain with antennas that they build, usually, in their backyard, transmitters that they build or acquire, that they put into their shack. The average moon-bounce installation requires, let me drop, something like 1,000 watts or more of power into the antenna, an antenna of close to 30 decibels of gain. If you did it on 432 with conventional moonbounce, I'll explain that in a minute, at least 1,000 or 1,500 watts of power output delivered to the antenna, and the antenna is an array, whether it be a dish or a phased array of Yagis or a phased array of collinear antennas or whatever, the array is approximately 20 foot on a side, 400 square feet of antenna, roughly 1,000 watts or more of power going into it. That's the uplink to the moon. That gives you a potent enough signal that when it hits the moon and bounces back, the signal being received by an antenna of approximately that size into an extremely low noise figure preamplifier, something like 3 or 4 tenths of a dB of noise figure on the preamplifier, into a good receiving system will give you Morse code, that is, I'm picking a number now, 5 dB or so above threshold of a set of human ears connected to the earphones, connected to that receiver. As you can see, moonbounce really separates the men from the boys. Lots of state-of-the-art hardware. Not very many guys have an XYL, but that'll let them put up 400 square feet of antenna in the backyard and transmit 1,500 watts into it. And a few of those guys will get a special temporary authority where they go even to higher powers to make it sound good. Along comes the Joe Taylor techniques, the digital techniques, where a much smaller amount of power into a smaller antenna by way of the digital processing techniques can give you moonbounce with less enthusiastic equipment. And so the old-fashioned moonbounce guys are very unhappy, let me drop, that to get 15 countries on moonbounce has taken them 10 years of their life, and along comes these Joe Taylor digital techniques, and a guy with 2 Yagis and 150 watts is now running up 15 countries of moonbounce contacts, and he does it in 3 months. And Is it a fair comparison? Well, there's a lot of discussions on that. So, as you can see, to set up a good moon-bound microwave antenna system has some of the similarities of a solar power satellite. The technology has similarity. And by the way, when it comes to an antenna, you'd like to know what kind of beam width can you get out of an antenna. The laws of physics will limit that. In the case of your laser pointing pen, a very small emitting surface of a couple of millimeters in diameter gives you a beam that has a very small spread angle to it. You can flash that beam 1,000 feet away and see a nice dot of green or red, if you know what I mean. And in the case of that laser pointing pen, or in the case of any antenna that you and I have ever built, or any feed on we ever set up, with a very interesting universal law of physics, 70 degrees divided by the number of wavelengths. Let me explain that. If you tell me how many wavelengths wide is that feed on, or how many wavelengths wide is that antenna, take that number of wavelengths and divide it into the number of approximately 70. That tells you how many degrees of beam width you can achieve. If I made my antenna 70 wavelengths wide on 432 megacycles, that would be a 140-foot wide antenna. If I could do that, 70 wavelengths wide, I divide 70 wavelengths into the number 70, I'll get 1 as an answer. In other words, a 70 wavelength wide antenna, 140-foot wide antenna, can create a beam that has a beam width of 1 degree. That tells you how much focusing you can do. You can't do much better than that. If you want to get a really sharp beam with very little spread to the beam, must invest in real estate. You've got to have the right number of wavelengths of horizontal dimension and right number of wavelengths of vertical dimension if you want that to be a nice pencil beam coming out of your antenna that is carefully focused. So with that rough rule of thumb in mind, you can now, on the back of an envelope, you can easily calculate how big should you make the phased array in space so that when that wave goes from space 36,000 kilometers away and comes down to Arizona, how wide a spot on the ground is possible if I do the best possible focusing for that frequency I've chosen. So you can now juggle easily with that simple rule of thumb. You can now juggle the numbers of what frequency should I run it at, how big should I make the antenna in the spacecraft, and how big should I make the antenna in Arizona. That's where you want to do the collecting. So you can study all these parameters and have a grand old time with it. So you can see how it kind of relates to the really serious ham radio operators. And although Wesley's question, somebody may say that, gee, this is pretty far off of the TechNet ham radio subject. To me, that's dead center on ham radio among the serious operators. Thank you, Wesley. I got to move on to the next guy, Lou, into YJC. If you go to QRZ.com, you'll see a beautiful picture of Lou sitting in front of what I think is some nice Kenwood equipment. He's a serious guy in Lindbrook, correction, Lindenhurst. Eventually get it right, Lou. What would you like to talk about tonight, Lou? N2YJC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, N2YJC. That's a pile of Yaesu stuff sitting on top of Amitron solid-state HF amp in that particular photo. Yep, that's what it is. Anyway, I have one real simple question, Dick, and then one that may require a little bit of thinking. The first one is, if I build a halo or squalo antenna, let me drop a sec. Maybe you can tell me what the timer is on this machine next go around. But anyway, if I build a halo or a squalo type of antenna for horizontal polarization for the mobile, Dick, how high off the roof of the truck or the car do I need to put it? Is there a magic distance? I certainly don't want to create a beam pointing straight up, if you know what I mean. So that should be a simple one. The second topic is I have an HF setup in my truck, and I bought an automatic antenna tuner for my Icon Mark II G. It's one of these LDG automatic tuners. It's the Z11 Pro. And I'm using a CB vertical antenna on the back of the car. And the thing works wonderfully. The thing works great on 6 through 40 meters with that antenna tuner. It's a great tuner. It doesn't work at all on 160, of course. But the root of the question is on 80 meters, it tunes up just fine when it's raining out, or the road is wet underneath the truck. And then, of course, when it's dry out, I can't get the thing to tune. So my question is, what's really happening when it's wet out? And is it something to do with capacitance to the truck body, to the ground? I'm getting more of a counterpoise, or maybe you can comment on that. And then whatever is happening, what can I do to the truck chassis to make it couple better to the earth? Does that make any sense? K2RIW and 2YJC.
Very fine, Lou. It makes a lot of sense. To my knowledge, the first question is that this is a 90-second timer, 1.5 minutes. And I exceed it every so often when I get excited, as you can tell. Should, in between transmissions, wait for 3 solid beeps to make sure that other portions of the system do not get timed out. Your first question is with reference to a square low or halo antenna. And I'm going to make a guess that you're talking about 2 meters. You haven't said. Halos have been used on 6 meters, but 2 meters and 450 have more recently been used. The Squalo antenna is made by Mike Stahl of M Squared, I think it is the name of the company. I own one of those Squalo antennas. And on 2 meters, I was transmitting 180 watts into that antenna. Back in the late 90s, I used to be traveling every weekend up to...
Tonight at 8 o'clock, net. Tonight at 8 o'clock.
Gee, I think I'm going to tune into that net tonight at 8 o'clock. Anyhow, every weekend back in the late 90s, I used to travel to Utica, New York, because I was working at the Romeo Development Center on an antenna development project for about a six-month period of time. And each weekend I would come home and on Friday night. Each weekend I would, on Sunday night, go back to Utica and transmit with that Squalo antenna on top of my station wagon. And I talked to people I have trouble thinking of his name. The man in southern New Jersey. terrible. K2. Can't think of his name right now. Can't think of his call letters. And he just moved. But anyhow, he had a good 100-foot antenna, 100-foot high tower with a good array of 4 Yagis on 2 meters. And from southern New Jersey to Utica, New York, I would talk to him all the way on the expressway with that Squalo antenna, horizontally polarized. I then put a 5/8 wave whip antenna also on the car, and I flip back and forth between the two. And while I'm going through the canyons of the New York State Thruway and up on Route 90, when I flip back and forth with a relay in the car, and I would listen to him transmitting to me with his horizontally polarized array of 4 Yagis, whether I listened to him horizontally or vertical did not matter. He sounded the same. And that Squalo in my case was above the roof of the car, about a foot, because that was the length of the rod that M Squared provided for me with the mag mount on the bottom of it, with the Squalo on the top of it. I think it was about a foot long, maybe it was 14 inches, in that order. It's a matter of wavelengths. Let me drop. On 2 meters, a quarter wavelength is 19 inches. Does the antenna have to be 19 inches off the metal of the car? Not that much. Probably 12 inches would do it. As you start getting down to approximately 6 inches, you're going to get a lot of degraded performance on the horizon, in my opinion, because you're now getting down to a very small fraction of a wavelength. So that horizontally polarized antenna above the metal roof of a car, you'd like it to be close to a quarter wavelength if you can get it. 19 inches would be perfect, but I think 12 or 14 inches will do it on 2 meters. And since you're at 3 times higher frequency on 450, divide all those numbers by 3. You'll notice one other thing about the M Squared Squalo antenna. Mike Stahl is a guy who lives in the Mojave Desert of California, or at least near there, where he almost never sees rain. So he doesn't understand when I complain about rain characteristics of that antenna. That antenna in the rain and snow degrades itself so rapidly.